Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of UFTronomy Radio. Today is Sunday the 13th, 2011, and today's show is entitled Tar and Feather. We're going to be discussing the plan for the restoration of our constitutional government. Now, restoration is an important word there. And we're not trying to change our government. We're not trying to do anything to install new government. We're trying to get back to the Constitution and what it is, to get away from judicial interpretation and review, to get away from judicial legislation, to get away from interpretation that just is not there. And as many of you know, we've been, Gary and I have been actively working on presenting a solution to the problems that we face today. And tonight we'll be discussing the 10 phases of a hypothetical plan, if you will. So with that in mind, Gary. Oh, before we start, there is going to be, we have our toll-free line set up. If you have any questions, you want to call in, we have two toll-free lines. The phone number for that is 877-374-3980. 877-374-3980. The callers for the show is also being streamed live also from the American Radio Network. You can find them on TalkShoe. So for any of the callers there or any of the listeners at that area, if you have any questions, I believe if John Galt brings you on to his show and unmutes, I'll be able to hear your questions as well. If not, you can get your Skype name to me. My Skype is randy_mac. And we'll go from there. We'll see if we can't bring you in that way. Haven't simulcasted with anybody and tried to bring their callers in, so we'll see how it works. If not, you can go into the chat room at, well, I guess you can go into the chat room at Randy or at ufetomy.com, drop your Skype name there, and I can bring you in. But again, the 800 number is 877-374-3980. This will be the maiden voyage of our toll-free line. Calls will be answered in the order they were brought in, so we'll go from there. If you call in on the toll-free line, make sure that your questions are clear, concise, they're on topic. We don't want to go off on tangents. We've got 2 hours for a show, and we try and keep our show on topic as much as possible.
Now, those on American Radio, also, you can, if you, I guess you can ask on that program or chat with John and pass questions on through John as well if the phone lines are tied up. So where did this all begin? Links have gone out on both sides for a petition, the You Have Tread on Me petition, which is about 2.5 years old. It was intended to get out to the Tea Party people, hoping that they had progressed enough in the recognition of the destruction of constitutional government to realize that it was a good thing. There was a problem, though, and it was rather interesting that a lot of people would not sign the petition because they didn't like one of the many items in it. Now, the petition, understand, was not just against the Federal Reserve or any one of the many dozens of issues in the Patriot community. It was trying to consolidate solutions for all the problems that were easily addressable by legislation by the Congress and consistent with the Constitution. A lot of people would not sign the petition with all of its items in it simply because there was one thing they objected to. So to think that we would accept what we've got now because I object to one of those was just, it was appalling to me, but I guess it makes sense to people. But the petition was modeled after the Olive Branch Petition of 1774 from the colonies to the crown, the one that the king laughed at. They had sought the Olive Branch Petition to, 1775, to stop the conflict that was going on in the colonies and return to a friendly relationship with England. Now, Sam Adams, John Adams, the people that were more astute back then realized that there's no way the king's going to recognize this petition. However, others, that wanted to restore relations felt that it would work. Now, the beauty of the petition is, if it had been acted on by the Crown, it would have solved the problems and we'd still be a British colony. That's not a beauty, but it is a beauty because of the way it worked out. The other side, though, is not on who is being petitioned, rather those that are petitioning, recognizing that those people that we've been petitioning really don't give a damn about us, and they're going to go about their merry way with total disregard for any rights that we might have. The English, the colonists, by their charters, were supposed to have the rights of Englishmen. Now, there's an English constitution. It's never been written. It's just an accumulation from the Magna Carta forward of certain principles, and there were a number of revolutions in England to establish some of those principles. But it was a constitution. It was referred to as a constitution, even though, unlike ours, it was not written. The objection they had was the constitution was not being abided by. They were being denied the rights of Englishmen. Well, I'm being denied the rights of an American, just like they were. The similarity between what happened then and what's happening right now is so close when you compare the two and the times and how things are treated. They couldn't go to Parliament, and Parliament couldn't to seek redress. We can go to our state governments, and we can go directly to the federal government, but we can't seek redress. Theirs was a government 4,000 miles away. To us, the government's an average of 2,000 miles away. Communications is better, but it serves less purpose probably than it did then, because they ignore us completely, and at least King George III laughed at the petition. So where does that take us? Since we're in the same boat that the founders were in, if we recognize our relationship with government, that we've lost our rights and our constitution is being ignored, we're in exactly the same boat. The difference is, over the last 230 years, the playing field has changed drastically. Back then, for example, they could kidnap somebody, say a tax man. They could tar and feather him, put him on a cart, drag him through town, and hang a sign around his neck. He may die as a consequence of the tarring and feathering. When the tar was removed, quite often it took off skin and opened it up to infection. They didn't have as good a medicine, so the guy might die. So you could say many times they kidnapped and then murdered the tax collector. They destroyed private property. Governor Hutchinson's house was torn down. Some warehouses were torn down. Some tax collection offices were torn down. Over $1 million worth of tea was dumped, destruction of private property dumped in the harbor. But in all those cases, nobody was ever charged with the crime. Clearly, those acts, all of them, were illegal, but nobody was charged in a crime. Now, if you could imagine even breaking a window in the governor's house now, you'd be in jail in no time, because we have what the founding fathers considered a standing army in this country today. It's called law enforcement officers, but if you look back at what they perceived to be a standing army, what we have today in the about 1 million-man law enforcement agencies in this country is that standing army, where they're there to enforce the law. In fact, they've got more rights in enforcing the law than the British soldiers did back then, and the best example of that is the Boston Massacre. The soldiers were surrounded. They were being pelted by stones and ice and boards. They shot back in self-defense. They killed some people. They stood trial for that. All but two were acquitted, and the two sought refuge of the church and were branded on their thumbs and then released. Ruby Ridge, Idaho, Waco, Texas. Nobody has ever stood trial on the government side for the clear murder of people in this country. So what we have now has a total disdain for our rights, and rights fundamentally. What's the most important right we have? That's the right to life, because without that, nothing remains. Nothing else matters. Freedom of speech don't matter if you're dead. Freedom of religion don't matter if you're dead. Nothing matters if you're dead. So life is the fundamental right that we enjoy and should be protected from government as it was back in colonial times. But in this country today, your life doesn't mean anything to government. Anything they do is justifiable homicide, and they walk without a jury trial as those soldiers had to face in Boston. So if we look at the playing field as it's changed from then to now and take the events that occurred during that period of time, we find that we can, if we apply what they did to today's playing field, we can retrace their steps. Now, in all the revolutions in history, the only one that I'm aware of that did not create a void in government during the course of that revolution to be filled in by the most powerful, the most influential, the richest, whoever came in to fill that void, the only time in history that that void wasn't filled by something outside was the American Revolution. The committees of safety managed to keep civil government in order and criminal government to some degree throughout the colonies through the transition from royal government to ultimately the Constitution for the United States of America. The committees of safety called for the First, Second, and Third Continental Congresses. After the Third Continental Congress and the Declaration of Independence, the Congress was self-perpetuating. They had two sessions a year or more if necessary, but they continued their own meetings. So the committees of safety, while still existent and still picking the delegates to go to the convention, no longer had to call for the conventions to be held. The committees of safety began locally, and they sent their message up to the county level and then to the provincial level, the colonial level, the provincial committees of safety, and then ultimately to the Continental Congress. Everything that was done by the Continental Congress was actually a message sent up the system, not dictated down, top-down politics, but bottom-up politics. One of the best examples of this is something I found out rather recently, but I've confirmed it. Thomas Jefferson wrote a well-known document. It was approved on July 2nd, 1776, and signed on July 4th, 1776. It's called the Declaration of Independence. And what I found out recently, and surprised me, I was aware of a couple instances. There was one in South Carolina and one in Worcester, Massachusetts, where counties declared independence from royal government. They stepped away from their charters and said, we're going to govern ourselves. But when I read this book, American Scriptures by Pauline Maier, M-A-I-E-R, I was surprised to find out that there were over 90 declarations, that's right, almost 100 declarations of independence that were executed by different levels of people, all the way down to associations. You know, it might be some mechanic group that declared it. But for the most part, cities through the Committee of Safety, counties through the Committee of Safety, even entire colonies, states, had declared independence before Thomas Jefferson put pen to paper. He did not generate this. Yes, John, M-A-I-E-R. He did not generate the Declaration of Independence. He took what was available readily at the time, these declarations by other people, because through the committees of safety, this information went through all the colonies. He grabbed all these documents, sat down with them, took the best ideas, put some nice prose on it, and penned the Declaration of Independence that we're all so familiar with today. So it was not the Continental Congress that created this. It was the people at the local levels, 90 local levels, that had pushed this information up to be converted into the most famous document perhaps in world history. So that's the nature of how that transpired back then. So now we get, I see we've got, did somebody have a question?
No, not yet. I was just
okay.
Going to go on about the, you know, about how we came upon this idea of this U of Tredemy document, and then eventually I cultivated into a plan, which we'll be discussing tonight. So, but no, somebody commented in the chat room, though, that 90 declarations, well, they didn't learn that in school.
There's a lot you didn't learn in school, and I'm going to run into another one that I think is important to understand before we start talking about the plan. And this is based on a book called The First Revolution, and hold on just a second, I'll get the author of that, if I can find it. This is by Ray, The First American Revolution, by Ray Raphael, R-A-P-H-A-E-L. And this deals with Western Massachusetts, and it was something that I never realized before. But take it for a minute, Randy. I've got to rearrange something here.
Not a problem. Well, you know, when we talk about what we didn't learn in school, look through your school books. You know, you'll find mention of the Continental Congresses. You'll find mention of a Constitutional Convention. But you very rarely, if ever, find any mention of the Committees of Safety, the role they played.
Okay, let me correct you. It's not a constitutional convention. It was Continental.
Continental Congress and Constitutional. What was that?
Constitutional Convention came much later.
That's what I said. That's what I said. The Continental Congresses and a Constitutional Convention.
The Constitutional Convention was not called by Committees of Safety, though.
Oh, that well, it was called by the Continental Congress, though.
No, it was called under the Articles of Confederation, which came in 1781.
Oh.
Okay.
Well, there you go.
Okay, I'm back, and let's go into West.
We're not all perfect, and well, hell, I hit too many books read.
Randy specializes in a whole different area than I do. I like going into history and then writing the articles. I need to post a link to this article. But Western, we all think of the Boston Tea Party and the tea tax. And the people in Boston, Sam Adams, John Hancock, and all these, they become the source of our belief in what started the Revolutionary War, what led to Lexington and Concord. Well, this book that I just mentioned, The First American Revolution by Ray Raphael, blew that whole theory apart. What happened is two acts were passed, one right after the other. The first one was the Boston Port Act. And that's the one that, to make up for the lost tea, the British embargoed Boston, didn't allow any shipping to come in, and it's kind of like the IRS today. They throw you in jail so you can pay your taxes, but you can't make money to pay taxes, so you got to stay in jail. The old debtors' prisons work the same way. But because Boston was embargoed and the British were living in Boston and tearing down fences in the winter for firewood and food was scarce and had to come overland, during that period, committees of safety from various areas got blankets, clothing, food, and forage and shipped it to Boston for the people in Boston. Another role of the committees of safety. But something else happened about the same time. Just a few days later, Parliament passed what was called the Massachusetts Government Act. The Massachusetts Government Act basically revoked the Massachusetts Charter. It replaced all the judges in the judicial system and the court. Now, the court was also the legislative body, and replaced them with the Crown's appointees. As far as town meetings can be held no more than twice a year, and all the agendas had to be approved by England before the town meeting could be held. Now, this was in western Massachusetts, far away from Boston, and these guys were really at odds with the people in Boston. They didn't like it. So what they did is decided that they were going to shut down the courts. Now, the foreclosures were great. The money was being taken. They didn't have money to pay taxes. They didn't have money to pay debts, because everything was going through Boston back to England to offset this obligation to repay the East India Tea Company. So they were losing their land, their equipment, their livelihoods. So what they did is they grabbed their rifles and they went to the courthouses. Whenever a court was going to open its session, they forced the recognition of the judges and forced the court to close. Now, this is happening all over Western Massachusetts. And in many cases, tens of thousands of people under arms would show up and close the courthouse. Now, Gage had 3,000 troops in Boston. And here we've got tens of thousands of militia members in the Western Massachusetts area. Three times Gage was going to send his soldiers out to make sure the court stayed open. But when you're looking at, I got 3,000, they got 10, 20, 26,000 people. Do you send your troops out? That's kind of stupid. So he kept, each time he changed his mind, decided not to send the troops out. He reported back to England what was happening, and he started getting the pressure. You had better do something now. So he did. He decided that he would try and sneak into Concord in the middle of the night so they couldn't muster their forces. He'd steal the guns and ammo, get it back to Boston, be able to write a report and say, we got their powder, their ball, their cannons, we did something. Well, we all know how that turned out. But the cause of that was the fact that the farmers in Western Massachusetts gave Gage no choice but to try something. And what he tried, again, was in Western Massachusetts. It was farmers, not city slickers, in Lexington. It was farmers, not city slickers, in Concord. And it was farmers, not city slickers, that came from all around to shoot these people all the way back to Boston. So it wasn't Sam Adams and John Hancock, as we've been led to believe. Now, it is kind of hiding history, and has happened over a long period of time, as near as I can tell. The history of the Revolution didn't begin to get written until about 1825, when John Adams and Thomas Jefferson died on the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. People started realizing, well, putting that in modern times, at the end of World War II, nobody wrote books about their adventure or their ventures in the Pacific or in Germany. Very little history was written during that period of time, because people were just glad to get back with their families, get married, buy a house, get a job, raise children, and have family life after the ordeal they'd gone through. So the history tends to get written later, when people start thinking, well, if we don't put it down, we're going to lose it. And that's what happened in 1825. We started seeing histories of the Revolutionary Era getting written for the first time. But they were, since everybody at the time was an adult and had pretty much lived through it, was aware of it, a lot of it was tended towards very simple history, especially to teach the children that weren't born until after the Revolution what their history, what their heritage was. And the three things that become important when you're talking to young children are heroes, events, and dates. So early on, a lot of this was omitted for whatever reason. I can't say why Western Massachusetts was left out. But then as time goes on, even more gets left out. Now we might be starting to get into design. And while I post a link, Randy's going to tell you about his search for committees of safety, if Randy's awake.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Just talk. You just keep talking, so I don't know when to jump in. So,
well, I said anyway, Randy's going to tell us about his search for committees of safety. So, why don't you do that?
Okay, as I was saying.
Okay.
I own two sets of encyclopedias here. One day I decided to, you know, check out history again, see what they were teaching today. I found no reference to the committees of safety whatsoever, except the French ones, which were nothing even remote. They had a similar name. That was it. It wasn't even the same name. And we saw what happened with the French Revolution. That wasn't a good thing. So I checked the other encyclopedia. Now, this one was the Encyclopedia Internationale. I also checked Britannica, Encyclopedia Britannica. No reference there whatsoever. Although they did tell what the Continental Congress was. I did find an old reference to them in an old set of Encyclopedia Britannica I found at a used bookstore. I think this one was back from the 60s, somewhere in the 60s. So I did find that. But that's pretty much the only references you find in the three sets of encyclopedias that I found. So there's not a lot out there. And, you know, Gary's even made mention to the fact that even from a Disney movie, Johnny Tremaine, when you watch the movie now, there's a cut in the movie, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense at a point because they took out an entire section that was talking about the committees of safeties and the role they play. Now, when you add that back in, all of a sudden the movie makes sense, that area makes sense, and you understand what they were, what was going on at that time and what was happening. But even from Disney movies, references are being taken out. There's a reason for that. I mean, those with power don't want you to know the things that they have done throughout the history. The victors always write history, and it's always written from their perspective. Even Winston Churchill, who thought he was at the pinnacle of knowledge, who thought he was a player in the game, if you will. In his memoirs, he wrote that he was amazed to find out that entire histories were being rewritten as they were happening by an even more powerful group of elite at the top who determined what everybody was being taught. And he was amazed to find out that he didn't even know about this till much later in life, even after he was prime minister. So history is one of those things. It's hard to find. You have to read a lot of it. You have to dig through it. And unfortunately, after thousands of books, things just start to get jumbled every once in a while, too.
Okay, I'll pick it back up now, Randy. Hobbit's been posting committeeofsafety.org. I just gave the URL to what I consider to be the proper page for committee. Then in another note, somebody mentioned Committee of Correspondence. Now, Sam Adams established the Committee of Correspondence, and I think it was 1773, because he wanted to set up a communication between the colonies so the other colonies could be aware of the events that were occurring in Massachusetts. Adams had like Paul Revere, had a tendency to exaggerate certain things as well. So he set up the Committees of Correspondence. Now, some of them carried that name throughout the Revolution. In fact, some of the Committees of Safety actually went by the name of associations. And so the Committees of Correspondence was really a newcomer to the game. It was established for a certain purpose, but in many of the communities, since they existed already, they just carried on and began conducting themselves as a Committee of Safety. So back to where we were. Gage had no choice but to try and sneak into Lexington Concord. We know what happened from them. So now the plan fix up. Now understand, the question that I was asked a few years ago was, is it possible to conduct a revolution in this country today? And my first reaction was no. It'd be almost impossible because we're in a police state. They've got cameras everywhere. They've got microphones everywhere. We can't get together. We'll get arrested for doing anything. But as I thought about it, I realized that there was a possibility that it could be done, and I started putting pen to paper and developed this plan that is modeled after the occurrences of the Revolutionary period. Now, the first part of the plan is called small units, small acts of aggravation. This would be like going out and kidnapping somebody, tarring and feathering him, putting him on a wagon, toting him through the streets in public, embarrassing him, and perhaps he died. Maybe tearing down a house or a warehouse or a tax collector's office, or even dumping tea into the ocean. But we can't do those today because, the cameras are there, the cops. We've got a million cops in this country. You can't do it. If you kidnapped somebody and put him on a cart and tarred and feathered him and went down took him down the street, you'd be arrested before you got a block in the city. So the playing field has changed. That means that if we are to practice the same thing the Founding Fathers did, we have to be much more cautious in how we do something. So we have to do it in a covert manner. Sometimes when you have to do it in a covert manner and you don't have the freedom that they had then to do something in such an open manner, you might have to rely on more serious consequences for the, let's say, benefiting party of your actions. I wrote an article, let's talk about the Constitution, and presumably the government has rights that we gave them, and the Ninth and Tenth Amendment address that, and the government has presumed that it has the right to assassinate people, so I think we must presume that we also have the right to assassinate people. I have trouble saying that I could give that right to government and not have it myself. And since it's not denied me in the Constitution, then I must retain that. That's based on the government's interpretation of rights, not mine. But in this case, I acquiesce to the government. So, if we are to destroy property, kidnap and murder people, anything like that, it has to be done in a covert manner, because just like they weren't prosecuted back then, we have to avoid prosecution right now. So the only way to do that is to avoid being caught. And that forces us into a situation that is, to say the least, ticklish and uncomfortable. But if we can emulate what the founders did to regain this country, then that is one of the means that they have left to us to act upon to return to constitutional government. Now, part two of the plan just expands that. I've got a group here that's exercising that rights, another one over here, and if they're close together and they get larger and larger, eventually they'll make contact with each other, and all of a sudden we're able to conduct greater acts of aggravation. Small units in small regions, like, say, counties, join together and do greater acts of aggravation. Now, at this point, the militia and the committees of safety are just saying, hey, something's happening. Let's get a little more organized. It's prep time. But as these acts of aggravation continue, somewhere along the line, the government will react, as Gage did when he went to Concord. Now, it might not be like Lexington and Concord. I have no idea what the government might contrive as the means of trying to strike back at the farmers in western Massachusetts shutting down courthouses. But they will react. Now, somewhere along the line, then, the committees of safety, when that reaction starts, will have to look at their community as something that they have an obligation to defend. So they will move into a defensive posture in their community, and to a degree, offensive as well, because if you're in a rural town, for example, and I would expect that, like back then, it will happen in a rural town, a farming community, more than in a large city, that you have to look at your town and say, okay, we've got a bunch of people here that realize something's happening, and I think it's in our best interest to get the chief of police or the sheriff or both of them to understand that we're going to protect the Constitution, and we see the government is becoming tyrannical and they're going to start doing this. So let's talk to the sheriff and the chief of police and see if they will come and join us in the constitutional forces side of this issue. So the sheriff and the chief of police say yes or no. Now, if they say no, that means that, hey, you're the royal government then, and we're the committee of safety, and we will no longer recognize you because you're representing that despotic government just like those judges in western Massachusetts. So you're out. And so you remove them and you take over. Now, if they're cooperative, then they've joined you, and all of a sudden, now the simple explanation of the Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government talks about a black map covered with despotism, and these little white dots appear, and then two dots join, and it becomes a larger and larger white area, and then some more dots join, and they become larger and larger, and that's the analogy we're going to see going through this. So as we take over the city and the county, we start bringing more and more into the white area. Now, if we have to use offensive force to bring somebody into the white area, we have to, because for our own security, we can't leave that pocket inside of our boundaries. We can't leave that pocket on the fringes of our boundaries. Now, there's a saying from Vietnam, it's called the hearts and minds. It's never worked with the military, with our military, and trying to apply it in any country in the world, but it could apply here because our hearts and our minds are the same as many people in this country, and when they realize what we're doing, that we are trying to restore the Constitution, the likelihood of them joining us, if as long as we're decent in our respect for them, we're not abusive in what we do, is great. And so that white area gets larger and larger as we go. Now, one of the things we can expect government to do somewhere along the line is start disrupting communications, electrical power, things like that. Nope, got ahead of myself. Part four in the plan, coordinated efforts securing facilities, allegiance, and prisoners. So as we expand this areas, we get people to sign a loyalty oath, and we take prisoners where there's outright resistance. You know, they can leave the white area, or we're going to incarcerate them. And if we've taken over the jails, then we can incarcerate them. So we've established the community that operates within itself, just like they do today, but we've wrested it from royal government and put it in the hands of the Committee of Safety. And again, this is following the pattern that occurred during the Revolutionary War. Now, if you go and read the plan, which if somebody could put a link up to it, if I haven't already, that's exactly what they did. They took over the courts. They actually stopped all civil proceedings in most areas and dealt only with criminal proceedings. If there was a necessary civil one, they might deal with it. But all criminal proceedings were there. And if there were accusations that this guy's a Tory, they would hold a hearing or a court proceeding. The jury would determine if he was a Tory or not. Sometimes they would be put in jail. Other times they would just be allowed to stay at home to care for their family, but they would have their long rifles taken away from them. However, ironically, they were allowed to keep their pistols for self-defense. That's how important life was back then. You can't keep your pistol now if something happens, I can guarantee you. But at this point, when we're at the county level, we've got to start thinking of the militia as a larger element than it was before, when it was just the town or a small group of people, like most militias are today if we look at the geographic areas. So in the plan, I've put what I found to be a standard allocation of unit size and what the command of that unit size was from squad up to an army, just for reference. And so as the militias and committees of safety come together, they start incorporating this group first into platoons, then into companies, then into battalions, and maybe in some counties even a regiment, 2,000 to 3,000 men. So after we've secured the counties, the part five of the plan, institution of governmental elements in the county. At this point, we picked up the responsibility to assure that the county functions the way it is, should function for the good of the people. Now, that doesn't mean welfare, but at the same time, if people are on welfare and have no means of livelihood, we have an obligation to make sure they're fed. We have to make sure that medical facilities are available. We have to make sure that sanitary water is provided through the public water systems, unless people are on wells. We have to make sure that when the toilet flushes, it flushes. So we've got to integrate ourselves into the existing county structure to the point that we're assuring that the county is operating in a proper manner. Now, this is hearts and minds, because now we're not just red dotting the whole place and nothing works. We're making sure that everything works. And as people see us making sure that everything works, they're going to say, hey, these are the good guys. And so our arms are always open for people to join us, take the loyalty oath, and assist us in restoring constitutional government. Next step, continuation of flow of goods, utilities, and communications. Now, over a broader area, we've got a responsibility, too. People talk nowadays about the possibility of a food shortage. That's probably real. This country used to be able to feed the entire country and large portions of the rest of the world. I don't know if the means are still here or not, but the means have to come back. So to do that, if I'm in a county, for example, where there's grain elevators, I've got to make sure that the grain comes in, gets processed, and goes back out and goes to Kellogg's, and Kellogg's makes the cereal, and the cereal gets then boxed and shipped. And once it's shipped, they've got to make sure that it gets out to where it's supposed to go. So that whole process of production has to be protected by those elements of constitutional forces that are within an area where any of these activities occur, the farming, the production, the transportation. That means railheads have to be secured by us. We've got to get people in the existing railroad staff to support us and do their job to make sure things flow, or move them out and move people up that do have some training in it. If we have to have militia remain on guard around the facilities, we have to have the militia remain on guard around the facilities, whatever is necessary. If, say, Kellogg said, no, we're not going to produce food, you guys are illegal, well, let's take these guys that say we're illegal and take them out, let them stand trial, see if they're going to go to jail or go home and get their long rifles taken away. But look at the staff that's there and say, is anybody else qualified to run this operation? Sooner or later, we'll find somebody that can, and if we can't, we'll find somebody that can learn to run the operation and make it work. I'm sure the workers, as long as they get their pay, are going to be happy at what we're doing. So now we've got some hearts and minds because they didn't lose their job, and we're making sure that their production will go as quickly as possible, overtime if necessary, so we can feed a nation. Transportation or the farming. In the longer version of the form, I use the example of Monsanto. If there's a Monsanto plant in your area of concern, you go into Monsanto plant and say, well, here's what's going to happen. We're going to, and this is true with everybody, we'll recognize 10% profit, but there's no advertising, there's no executive privilege. You're not going to get exorbitant salaries if you're management. You're going to get reasonable salaries. But we will assure the corporation 10% profit when this is over with. We don't want to steal from them, but we are going to commandeer them for the purpose of assuring that people are fed. So we go to the Monsanto plant and say, okay, we're taking over here. And however many militia members you need to secure that plant, it's done. And we do the same thing to management. Here's what we expect. First, you need to start production of heirloom seeds. We're tired of this genetically engineered, all these other modifications you've made to seed. That's out the window. That's done. You will produce no more. You will produce heirloom seeds. You will continue producing other things that we deem. Keep refining, and you will keep pumping to distribution points so that there's fuel. Now, very probably and very practically, it might be necessary to ration fuel, because I would expect that these big super tankers headed this way, the ones that were on their way would probably come and unload as long as they were assured payment. But I would think if this was happening in this country, a lot of foreign countries would not want to take a risk or face the wrath of the United States government or United States Navy in continuing transportation. So more than likely, at least as far as fuel, we would be dependent upon domestic supplies, which means we have to increase the production of domestic supplies, anticipating that the imported oil is not going to be there. But everything I understand is that the domestic supply is probably sufficient to meet the demands with rationing. Did we lose the stream? Is that?
Oh, we're good. People just needed to refresh the page, apparently.
Oh, okay.
People lost the stream, so they had to just go back and refresh the page or hit stop and then press play again.
Okay, so utilities and communications need to be remain open as well. In many communities, water travels hundreds of miles to supply the needs of the community. Communications is the important one, and I think we all anticipate that communication will be shut down. Well, it's our job to restore it and make people happy and see that we're the good guys. Everything we do is to replace the existing infrastructure, government, and everything with something that we keep operational without great profit to somebody. A lot of prices might be reduced as a consequence of what we're doing. Then we, the extension of influence into the state government. Now, as the counties grow and begin merging county to county and the white areas in the state become 30, 40, maybe even 50%, that, even though the capital might remain out of the white area, at that point, we've got sufficient number of people in that state that can declare that they're a state. Now, when we get three or four or five states, they can begin communicating as a Continental Congress. Now, we can't do it before then, because if you had a real Continental Congress and people that were a threat to the government, they'd get arrested when they got to Philadelphia. But now we've got communication back. If they're close to each other, they can join together somewhere and meet. They can do it. We've retained the communication network, and whether internet is up or down, we still have communication. So they can begin starting to talk about what needs to be done and how we can expand our areas of influence. And perhaps at this point, we'd be in a position to assist other counties or perhaps other states so that we could join the white spots together more and more. Next step is extension of influence into federal government agencies. Now, these aren't all necessarily chronological because you're going to encounter a lot of government, federal government agencies at the city and county level, especially at the county level and at the state level. You're just going to run into virtually hundreds or thousands of government agencies. If they're constitutional, that's great. Let them stay open. But I can't think of a federal agency that's constitutional. I'm not sure. But I don't recall that the Constitution authorized that type of element. So if they're not constitutional, shut them down. And since they were bought with the people's money, that becomes a source of revenue. Sell or lease the building to somebody that needs it. But we have to extend our influence into these federal agencies. Now, there's a liaison committee established in the more involved plan. And that liaison committee is constantly reaching out, talking to a federal agency and saying, look, we're going to be here coming your way soon. Would you like to join us or not? And trying to very diplomatically talk people into realizing which side they should pick to be on. So we start incorporating all the federal agencies, continuing their service. If it's a necessity, if it's welfare, it's not money, it's food. Until we can, and whenever possible, to provide employment for these people. As we take the administrative agencies, we begin cutting off the tentacles of an octopus that's caused this whole thing to turn black in the first place. We continue up extending our influence into the federal level as more and more counties come in. This is step nine, or part nine. We started extending our influence into federal agencies at a greater level. We contact the Department of Interior, the Treasury Department, DHS even, yes, and the DOD, all these agencies, and start advising them. You see what's happening. You either join us or you don't. If you don't, you'll stand the consequences. If you do, start making preparations to welcome us. If this works as I expect it could, if we're committed to it, that we'll see a lot of federal agencies kind of distancing themselves from the executive branch of government, perhaps even congressmen for the first time in their careers will fear the people. And that's what causes change in government. The tenth step is restoration of constitutional government. Now, in the detailed plan, there, not the one that, did somebody get the link up for the abbreviated plan, by the way, or not?
The abbreviated plan? Not yet. I thought you were going to post it up there. I'll go post it here in a minute.
Oh, yeah, do it in Skype for John and on our page. If anybody's, the detailed plan is in a final draft form right now. I've got to add twice as long as the abbreviated form to it. It's over twice, but it does go into detail on structuring the committees of safety to deal with these different elements, what committees you need, ideas on how to go about things, reference material. For example, when it comes to reestablishing the judiciary in a constitutional manner, I've got an essay from, I think, 1812 or something like that, way back in the early 1800s, that deals with petite juries, and I've got an essay that was written in 1906 about grand juries, and believe me, what you see today, you would not recognize as the same styled object as what you will read in those essays. There's another recent one from 2006, titled Are Cops Constitutional? And it gives you a picture of what law enforcement was like 200 years ago. And it raises the same question I have for years. Do the law enforcement in this country, are they the standing army the founding fathers feared? And he agrees with me, they are. So that information is provided as background because as we take over these areas, we've got to reestablish government in a proper form, consistent with the Constitution. So to do that, you need to know what it was like then, and this is a problem we all have. What was it like then? We don't know. We're so far removed from what was given to us by the founding fathers, that you'll be surprised if you read those various essays at how remote that is to what we have today. So if we want to get back there, we have to understand what we want to get back to. In one of the articles that I've linked in the longer version, it actually creates the analogy that if you watch a baby grow, you don't see the changes. But if you come back 10 years after the baby's born, you see the big change. Well, we were watching the baby grow over the last 200 years, 150 years, and we don't know what the changes are, and we can't jump back unless we can find some pictures of that baby when it was a child to see, now that it's a man, see what it was like back then. So these become pictures into the past so that we can understand what really should be. I'll give you a good example. There's a case from 1890s called John Baddock versus United States. It's rather interesting, but it has to do with the fact that a warrant is required to arrest somebody. John Bad Elk was at home, and a couple of deputies came to his place and said, John Bad Elk, you're under arrest. I think it was on a Saturday or Sunday. He said, well, you tell the marshal that I'll be down there Monday morning. He said, no, you're under arrest now. John Bad Elk picked up his rifle and shot the guy dead. The guy had a rifle, but he never raised it. And John Baddock shot him dead. Well, the state court found him guilty. He appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court ruled that John Baddock was remanded for improper jury instructions. But as they said in the decision at the Supreme Court, that if it is an unlawful arrest being served, if he kills the act or the person serving the warrant, it may be a misdemeanor or no crime at all. So if it's an illegal warrant and you shoot the guy serving it and he dies, that may not even be a crime. It may be a misdemeanor if the warrant was unlawful. So if we look at what's an unlawful warrant, if we understand what should be, no person shall be held to answer for a capital offense, capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia. So that means only a grand jury can issue a warrant. As far as arrest, the court decision said that if a law enforcement officer sees somebody in the commission of the felony, he can make an arrest only if it is to stop the completion of the felony. That's what we should have in this country. Now, it makes you wonder if justice would prevail or not, considering how much return to crime we have coming out of prisons, the high recidivism rates. But then if we look at the jury system, instead of having federal guidelines, Lindsay Lohan is not going to, all her crimes were California, which has the three strikes law, but Lindsay Lohan, for some reason, is not being subjected to the three strikes law. But a guy that steals donuts can be subjected to the three strikes law. I'm not quite sure how that works. But federal sentencing guidelines, state sentencing guidelines, this is bullshit. The jury should determine the degree of aggravation, the degree of justification, and the nature of the person, and decide guilt and punishment. There should not be guidelines that said, oh, he murdered seven people, but the guidelines say he only gets 5 years in prison. The jury can look at the guy, and if he was justified, because they feel he is not an asset to the society as a whole. That's the concept of jury as it existed then. Now the jury, last time I served jury duty, they didn't do this, but I've talked to people that have served jury duty recently, and they get a form, and it's a checklist. Did he do this or did he not do this? He did this. And if he had three did this, he's guilty, and here's what you got to sentence him to. So they actually instruct you with a checklist. They make you a mechanical reactor to what they want to determine innocence or guilt. We can look at prosecution side in federal cases. Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris is probably the best example in the world. The two, a U.S. Marshal and a U.S. attorney, were found to have falsified evidence in the Weaver-Harris trial. The U.S. attorney was seeking the death penalty for Weaver and Harris. So the U.S. attorney wanted to murder Weaver and Harris, and a U.S. marshal and a lower-grade U.S. attorney falsified evidence with the intention of trying to get a conviction that would result in the death of Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris. They were found out on the falsified evidence, and they were fined $2,000 apiece for falsifying evidence. The judicial system protects its own, it protects law enforcement, and it will not punish them. $2,000 to these guys making a couple hundred thousand, or say $80,000 or $100,000 a year is nothing, considering they tried to murder Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris. Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris were on trial for what Randy Weaver's son did in killing a U.S. Marshal. They didn't kill him. His Sammy Weaver did. So they were on trial for capital murder for what they didn't do. Where's the justice in a system that says the government is always right and you're probably always wrong? And if you're not wrong, the government is still not wrong. A guy named Frederick Bastiat wrote a book called The Law. Rather interesting book, but I think the most pronounced thing that I found in there that has stuck with me, and I'm paraphrasing Bastiat, but basically he said the definition of justice is the absence of injustice. Now, by that definition, we have no justice in this country today. So we need to get those things back. We need to look at the election process. I don't want to support the contention that the United States of America is a corporation. I don't buy that argument. We may make it a program sometime to explain why. However, if it were a corporation, any corporation, the people, the employees of the corporation don't vote on the corporation business. Only the shareholders do. Only those people that are vested in the corporation have a right to vote. We look back to earlier colonial times. Now, I just finished a book on the ratification, the people debate the Constitution 1787 to 1788. It is by Pauline Mayer. She's done a phenomenal job of pulling together the documents that are readily available, by the way, and I'm going to mention another book, American Archives by Peter Force. That's F-O-R-C-E. Now, he died a long time ago, but back in the colonial period, he's gathering documents and transcribing them and making a book with tens of thousands of records. He traveled all over the colonies, making copies of minutes of meetings, things like that to compile into, I think there's six volumes. The fourth one is the one that has most of this colonial era data in it. And Pauline Mayer relies heavily on that for her research. I finally got a copy of that book in a reduced version. But in the ratification process was rather interesting because she talks about how the delegates were picked in each of the colonies. And we think it was railroaded. The only state that railroaded the Constitutional Convention was Pennsylvania. The population was in the east, and they didn't even let word get out to the west, and they called the convention quickly. The other states, they would not allow people holding office to be delegates. For the most part, those that were allowed to vote were either freeholders or freemen. Freemen had to have 15 shilling in the good or some fixed amount. Freeholders had to own land. It had to be a larger acreage in the country or at least some a lot or something owned in the city. They had to own land. Now, these people, if they owe nobody and if they own something, they're vested in the country. But in this country today, we've got people that stand in line for their welfare checks and all the freebies they can get, and we've given them the vote. They're the employees. We're paying them to work. But they don't have to work to get paid, and we're giving them the vote. One thing we need to consider very seriously is the fact that responsible people that can step up in life and make something of themselves are much more qualified than somebody that can stand in line for hours to get a free check in making the decisions that determine the course of this country. So there's a link in there, thoughts on the election process that goes back into this. We have to look at the qualifications of the people that we allow to vote. If we don't, we're going to allow those people that are getting a free ride, a chicken in every pot, to get two chickens in every pot because they're fast becoming the majority in this country. And if we turn it over to them, they will decide that everything we make will go back to them. I think we're seeing that right now, aren't we?
A little bit.
Oh, well.
Look around. That's all we see anymore today. Well, open your eyes and it'll be more than evident.
So a lot of the articles that are linked in the draft final version of the plan will go into these details and give some insight, historical insight, to what should be. And let's see, I'm about talked out, so anybody got any questions? Or Randy, you want to pick it up for a while?
Yeah, what I wanted to do is, since, you know, the plan is really, the abbreviated version of the plan is really short. In fact, you know, a few days ago I read it, when we were talking about a different way to present it or something, maybe changing up the way it's presented, I read it over 8 times, and it didn't take very long at all. I mean, it took me about 10 minutes to read each one, but unfortunately it seems that a lot of people just don't want to read anymore. And it's not on YouTube. So what I wanted to do was go through and address specific areas of each plan, each phase of this hypothetical plan that we're talking about here, and just go into a little bit of detail on it. You know, show what it really is, what's really in it, what it's about.
Well, you're familiar with it. You pick a point and we'll go into it.
So we've already gone over the preface and what it's about and things like that. So let's talk with Phase 1, small units, small acts of aggression. And let's refer a lot of this back to the revolutionary period, okay? But during this period, during this phase, you know, you talk about small acts of aggression, small units, kind of like the Boston Tea Party, if you will, referring back to the revolutionary period, the tar and the featherings you were talking about, people being kicked out of town and told never to come back. Now, what, in this hypothetical situation, you know, what forms could this take today, you know, in this country that's been overtaken by tyranny?
Well, we have to look at what they perceived as, let's say, quote-unquote, evil back then, and that was the tax without direct representation, at least in Boston, in the major cities. The farmers were concerned too because the taxes were hitting them on their land. So the tax collector was obvious. He was somebody that was denying people their rights all the time. But in the abbreviated version, I've got a a list of some examples. Law enforcement officers who have abused citizens without provocation. Now, that's kind of like the British soldiers in the Boston Massacre. It's kind of like the tax collectors. They have an authority, but these guys have guns. Law enforcement officers, if they kill somebody, let's see, I'm a law enforcement officer and I'm out of vacation time, I'm out of sick time, I only get a month or two, a year of that stuff, and I want to go on vacation. If I go down and kill somebody, I'm going to be suspended with pay during the course of the investigation, and that could take 3 or 4 months. So if I shoot somebody, I get a paid vacation, and it doesn't come off my vacation time. Put that aside, there's no motivation for a cop to shoot anybody for any reason unless he is honestly threatened. When I was a kid, there was an old saying that the cop had to fire a warning shot, that he could not shoot at anybody unless he was shot at first. I don't know how true these were. I remember them from when I was a kid. I saw them on television. I don't know if it was true or not, but it seems like a good idea, and for some reason that was circulating. But now law enforcement officers will pump 86 rounds into somebody that's unarmed, and the worst they get is a paid vacation. Who knows? They might get a promotion as two BATF agents in Waco did. So, you know, law enforcers, if you know the individual and he has been abusive, he might be a target. Insurance companies have not fulfilled their obligation for losses. You know, the government licenses insurance companies, and, you know, we got Katrina, we got that, don't remember the name of the hurricane that devastated Miami, Florida. There's people in Miami that have not been paid back their losses yet. They paid their premiums diligently, but the insurance company didn't expect a hurricane, and so now they don't have the money to fulfill their obligation. That's theft. That's fraud. They took money under false pretenses. That insurance company should be a target. Those people will probably never get it back unless we take over that insurance company and make sure that it pays out if it's got the assets. But there was a promise, a contract there that was violated by the insurance company. Got no respect for them. People in positions of public trust who have blatantly violated their oath of office, there's somebody... Nancy Sinatra, Nancy something from California. I can't remember her name. Jane Doe, who has blatantly violated their oath of office and pushed through legislation that's absolutely unconstitutional. Now, if those people died of a sudden case of lead poisoning in the middle of the night, I wouldn't cry. And... you know, I wonder what the Founding Fathers would have done, those further along the line guys back then, if they saw these situations today.
But he also...
So, but how about the people in...
I think we got a caller trying to get in here.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Okay, am I on there? Yeah, this is a question. Okay, I've heard lots of conversation on chat and everything during this conversation. And one of them is about the lines, and, you know, one number one question that bugs me is because, and I've been asked this a lot, and maybe you know the answer to this question. They said that the militia cannot act on their own and break laws in order to accomplish a goal. Well, my question is, whose laws? I mean, even in the revolutionary days when they were fighting against the British government, the British, they were acting on what they felt was right and what they felt was unjust about the laws being passed down by the King of Great Britain. Okay, so when I hear people talk about the militia can't act unless they act legally and abide by the law, whose law? You know, whose law? What is the line? Okay, I'm gonna try to phrase this in a good question. Whose
let me
law?
See if I. Can. Let me see if I can answer that.
Okay.
There's two legals. One is illegal and the other one is unlawful. Now, unlawful is something in violation of the Constitution and violation of people's rights and everything. So who makes the laws? Who determines that? Well, I would suppose that when the committees of safety sent their militias to say Worcester, Massachusetts, to make sure that the court did not open and that the judges resigned, were breaking the king's law. But the Committee of Safety had decided that the king's law was not consistent with their charter or their rights or their constitution. So they said, we have a right to protect our constitution and our rights in imposing these judges on us in violation of the constitution is sufficient to determine that sending these 10,000 men down there, 26,000 men down there, is lawful.
Okay.
Now, it gets into a gray area because committees of safety did not send people into New York and Boston and Charleston to turn paper, and I don't know how many other cities, to tar and feather. I like that word, tar and feather. Tarring and feathering people was not condoned by the Committee of Safety. If you look at the Boston Tea Party, I can only find one guy on his deathbed that admitted to have been one of the Indians.
There's no record
of who these guys were. Now, they were not sent by the Committee of Safety. They may have been members of the Committee of Safety, but they were not sent by the Committee of Safety. So there is this point where people, in the case of the courts, where they felt that the government was out of hand and they could go with guns. Now, when they had those guns, if the judges didn't resign, I don't know if they would have used the guns. I think the judges wisely opted to resign rather than find out if they were going to use their guns or not. There were some beatings with sticks somewhere along the line, minor beatings, nothing serious. But the Boston Tea Party, the tarring and feathering, these don't have, and the tearing down of Hutchinson's house, these don't have Committee of Safety behind them. These are people conducting acts of aggression that are clearly illegal. The judges, again, was a question of, can we send our people to kick these people out because they're trying to impose something that's unlawful upon us?
Yeah.
Now, do you understand now? Does that answer?
Yeah, those are the ones that I've been calling lone wolves. The people that think that they were fighting against what they considered unjust laws, but without the legality behind the community. I'm trying to find a way to wear that. No, they answered the question.
Right.
Very
well,
because that question's been going around a lot.
Okay. And
who's legality?
In the plan. That's Timothy, and he's on WRAM.
Yes, it is.
And on the Outpost of Freedom, Group, there's an article in the discussions called Targeting. And if you go there, you'll see there's two different parts in the plan that I've talked about targeting. And it talks about you've got to make right decisions. I mean, you can't go to court. You can't hold a trial because then the people that are supposed to go out and do something have been exposed to whoever might be there during the trial. So they have to make decisions, and they have to think about it. And if they make a mistake, they have to bear the moral consequences of their action.
So the next one
on the list is people who have... And thanks for calling, Timothy.
Okay, you're welcome.
Next one is people who have proven themselves inimical... People who have proven themselves inimical to the Constitution. And now, right behind that is a link to bad guys. Bad guys was something I did about a year ago. I asked people to contribute names of people who would be collaborators if we had a Red Dawn and Russia or France or Mexico took over this country. Who would collaborate with the enemy under that circumstance? And so the bad guys links take you to a bunch of people that by their actions, which are explained at bad guys, these many dozens or hundreds of people have reasons that we would expect that they would be collaborators with the enemy should this country be defeated. Collaborators in France were the Frenchmen that sided with the Boche or the Germans. And we would expect these people to side with the foreign invader the same way. You know, just in case we get invaded, maybe these guys shouldn't be here to help the enemy. Then I mentioned Federal Reserve banks, nine banks, not all banks, but the Federal Reserve banks. There are nine Federal Reserve banks in this country. And I think everybody that's listening has an idea of how bad the Federal Reserve system is and how destructive it's been to our lives, our economy, our great-grandchildren. and how much influence they have in this country, an undue influence. Absolutely. And so if those banks fell down, it wouldn't bother me. Might destroy some worthless paper, 2.5 inches by 7 inches, whatever they are. Special interest groups inimical to the Constitution, and the two that I thought of when I put that down there were Acorn and SEIU. They are taking our money to do things that are illegal in this country. Courts won't do anything to them, whether it's SEIU units threatening voters or demonstrators, Tea Party demonstrators, whether it's Acorn people giving people advice on how they can get federal money by lying a little bit about what the difference between prostitution and something else. No use for these organizations, and those that head up those organizations are knowingly abusing our Constitution, and they're knowingly taking and asking for more of our money to continue abusing the Constitution. So that gives you an idea, but I would think that people would be somewhat creative in their determination of what a potential target was.
Well, we also talked about collaborators. You know, if we look back throughout any turbulent time in history where tyranny was rising up, there was always those within the community that would always turn upon their own people, and for favors from the new regime or money, whatever it was, there was always some reason they sold out their own people. Let's talk about collaborators.
Well, do we want to go to that? Put that link up so people can see who I think the collaborators are.
No, we know who those collaborators are. Those high power collaborators, you know. You know, the parallel government, if you will. We know those. I'm talking about local collaborators within your own community, the neighbor next door, those people that spy on you to report you to other people.
Unless you have tangible proof, the hard part. Well, let's go to what else I wrote on targeting on the plan. Some considerations for the evaluation of a target. Have lives been lost as direct or indirect result of the actions of the target, acting in violation of the Constitution or constitutional laws of the land? Has there been a continual loss of property by people who should have had the property protected under the Constitution or constitutional laws? If a foreign nation, say Russia, were to invade the United States, would the target become a collaborator turning against the United States government? And then below that, I've got a note, and this is for your consideration. The possibility that if there are sufficient collaborators of a foreign power, these collaborators might encourage participation by that foreign power, you know, invite Russia in, is to be considered. The discouragement of this sort of person, potential collaborators, would be as desirable as the discouragement of all other potential targets. So that's my take on the collaborators. Now, when you make a judgment, though, it's very important to consider that your judgment may stand on trial, at least before God, if not before people. So when you make a decision, you have to make sure that you have justified the action that you take. The worst thing that we can do is allow what Timothy wanted to call lone wolves to commit acts of retribution because they didn't like somebody. It cannot be used for personal gain or personal benefit. It has to be, the targeting has to be morally sound and justifiable with irrefutable evidence as to the nature of the person or the object of the that is targeted.
I agree. And, you know, if we look back, let's take Russia, for instance, during the Bolshevik Revolution, the installation of their socialist/communist regime. You know, we saw people, they turned their own citizens against each other. And a lot of these people were using that to gain revenge upon others that they just didn't like, or those who had done whatever to them in life. And I think if we become that which we try not, which we are fighting against, I think that really demeans us, and it will lead us down a path that isn't going to lead us back to the freedom that we're looking for. So I think we have to be very careful of, you know, if anybody's engaged in a tyrannical system in these environments, I think they have to be really careful in choosing who is the enemy and how they're going to deal with that.
Irrefutable proof is the only way, and remember that you may have to justify your actions, so make sure you document it. Make sure that you know that there's sufficient evidence to prove this person satisfied the criteria laid out, or any criteria. I mean, this is just some. There may be more. But if there's a valid criteria, make sure that's satisfied completely. Because you'll have to stand before man and God for your acts if they are not consistent with. Remember, the basic and most important right we have is the right to life. And so to deny that life, you better make sure that you're right.
Well, very true. You know, there were so many times in history where you can point back where revolution started off being for the people, about freedom, about resisting tyranny. And then when you see those little times where they started to deviate away from that, and eventually what you ended up, you always ended up with tyranny again because of those, the deviation from the plans and from deviating from what was right and what was just, as well as documenting and being able to prove and being able to justify your actions, if you will. So good points there, Gary. Thanks.
Well, here's something that I ran across in reading some of this older history that I thought was fascinating. I've only run across it once, but I haven't run across that many loyalty oaths. But it has to do with loyalty oaths, especially if it's not somebody that's been on our side from day one. But somebody comes over and says, yes, I want to join you. He needs to take a loyalty oath. Now, this was the final sentence, two sentences in a loyalty oath that I ran across. If I betray this oath, final sentence, I'm sorry, I agree to suffer the punishment of a traitor. If I betray this oath, I agree to suffer the punishment of a traitor. Now think what would happen in Washington if that were tagged onto the end of the oath those guys take up there to uphold and defend the Constitution. But think of the consequences on a local level. This guy joins you and he's lying, but he's taking this oath and you've got it in writing with his signature. And you find out he's turning information over to the rebels, and I'll get into the rebels in just a minute. If I betray this oath and he turns over that information, I agree to suffer the punishment of a traitor. Now, that means that he can be executed on the spot by his own agreement. He signed his death warrant when he violated that oath. Now, I said rebels. We were the rebels, redcoats and rebels. That was what we were back then. We were rebelling about against the imposition, against the charters in this country, partially, and against the English Constitution. But I was having trouble naming the two sides, and I still am. You know, the final version's not out yet. And I'm willing to change it if we get some good ideas. But what do we call the other side, the black side? Can't call them Darth Vader. How about we call them rebels because they have rebelled against our Constitution and put it in the garbage can? They have rebelled against our government. We missed it. They rebelled. They won. We missed it. So we're kicking out the rebels. We are the constitutional forces. Now, I've been searching for a better set of names for each side. One's white, one's black. We're the white guys, they're the black guys, they're the rebels, we're the constitutional forces. But if anybody's got a name, a good suggestion for either side that is an improvement on that, I'd appreciate it. But as you read the plan, when you see rebels, it's not the rebels, the colonist rebels, it's the people that have stolen our Constitution. They have rebelled against our Constitution. But remember that oath. If I betray this oath, I agree to suffer the punishment of a traitor.
Sorry about that. I got somebody that keeps calling.
I think I know who it is.
So, you know, you asked what they would do if they had to actually have that oath attached to their oath of office at the end. I think we know what they would do. They would just go back and redefine the definition of traitor. And, you know, a traitor become, you know, I don't know, the hero.
redefine it.
Up is down, war is peace.
Well, they would try, definitely. Now, you know, when you read the long version of the plan for restoration of constitutional government, you'll find in there that there are some steps at the state level and the federal level that need to be taken to get us back into constitutional obedience. And it does set up committees or conventions on the state level and the federal level to oversee government, not to replace the legislative capabilities, but the way it works is the oversight conventions, no law can be passed that isn't blessed by them as constitutional, and they can recommend by the legislature, and they can, so anything the legislator proposes has to go to this convention and say, yes, it's got constitutional blessing, or no, it doesn't. If it does, the legislature can then enact it. By the same token, the convention can recommend to the legislature things that should be done, but the legislature does not have to enact them. We don't want to violate the Constitution. That legislature is set there. We're establishing an interim body to assist them in getting back to the Constitution. There are also a number of recommended changes that I'd like to think that the legislature would accept. One would be to get rid of all administrative agencies because they're one of the greatest evils we have in this country. You may not realize how bad they are, but the IRS is one of them. And they make their own rules, by the way. So there are some things that are mandated there in the long plan. Anybody that wants a version of the long plan, it's in final draft form or draft final form. I'll be glad to send you a doc, Microsoft Word document, with that plan for you to look at and read. It's much more extensive. It's over twice as long as the abbreviated version that's online. So all I need is an email address, and you can Skype it. You can email it to me at hunt@outpost-of-freedom.com, requesting a copy of the plan, and I'll send it right back to you so you can read the fine detail.
Something I wanted to talk about also was in phase two, when these little white dots on that black map started coming together. We had talked about some of the infrastructure that would be needed to maintain transportation, railroad lines, things like that. I think that becomes a lot more important as these little white dots begin to merge with each other. Transportation of goods back and forth, logistics lines, things like that. But also, let's talk about now when those things begin to merge and the role that the committees of safety would end up playing there in coordinating their, the varying, those different groups of militias that are there as well. Because that's something that a lot of militia groups don't think about there, or they don't understand. Eventually your groups are going to have to work with other groups. And if there's not that civil authority overseeing the militia, then who determines who's in charge, who's the boss, things like that. I mean, it becomes a big, it becomes a mess.
Well, we're going to have another conversation on Tuesday that's going to overlap this to some degree, but I think the best way to address that is we're looking at people wanting somebody to stand up and speak nationally for the patriot community. That's a good way to get them shot or otherwise some severe, serious accident, a heart attack at age 23, something to happen to them. A national convention, well, that's been tried, but it's paid membership, and it hasn't worked very successfully. The true patriots are in your neighborhood right now. The true leaders, the leaders of the future, are down with you in the dirt right now. They're not up there saying, follow me. That's not the way it works. So the militia, an analogy I use, and it started in Georgia when I explained it to somebody from Georgia, but say you've got a county in Georgia and there's three militias in the county. And, they want to set up communication with the militias in Louisiana. What for? It's going to be months or years before you're in touch with Louisiana. It's nice to know names, and you can meet them when the time comes. But let's look at that county in Georgia with three militias in it. Let's just say they secure that county and it's all white. And then the next county says, we need some help. We can't get these guys out of here. Can you send us some militia units? Well, let's just say then that the militia units are independent. So the word goes out to all three, Militia A, Militia B, and Militia C. And all of them, seeking glory, say, well, I'm going to go to the next county and help them out. So All of a sudden, three militias leave this county to go to that county to help them out, leaving this county completely unprotected. If you have a committee of safety in the first county, the committee of safety will look at the three and say, well, we don't have quite enough for a battalion, but we probably should have somebody to coordinate this so they can commission somebody as a major to be over the other three. But more importantly, when the county next door says we need some help, the committee of safety, not seeking glory, but seeking protection of their own county, sits down and says, well, how many men can we get by with? Can we send one militia unit or two militia units and still protect our county? Well, we could send one, so let's send one. And that decision is made rationally. It's not made by the desire for glory. So you can see where the committee of safety, let's take another instance. Okay, the militia gets a call up. They're grabbing their gear. Make sure I got everything. Get out the door. Kiss the wife goodbye. They never seem to think when they go on this call to the militia that I might never walk back in that door, but they run out with all their gear on there, and they're striving to get there on time and all that. Meanwhile, the committee of safety can be evaluating the information that's coming in and making the best determination on where to place the militia for the protection of the community. These guys are too busy cleaning their rifles.
Mm-hmm.
So to have that objective overview of the committee of safety gives an advantage to the lives of the militia members so that they don't walk into a trap, so they go to the right place where they serve the greatest good. Now, the militia in the field has to decide if they're going to set up a defensive line, where best to situate that. But the direction they go in is something that is gathered by the intelligence acquired by the Committee of Safety. Now, when you read the extended version of the plan, you've got Intelligence Committee, Liaison Committee, Press Committee, Militia Committee. You might find need for more. But these people are working together, gathering information and making rational determinations. Now, who's good on, say, the Militia Committee and the Committee of Safety? Vietnam veterans. Why not? They understand combat. Probably, in some respects, better than the people in Afghanistan and in Iraq, because they had to go out and face the enemy in a situation much more similar to what we're going to be facing if we're fighting against rebel forces in this country. It's not going to be isolated groups somewhere that we want to chase down and get them out of a village or something. It's going to be battle line confrontation sometimes. No telling the size, and if the size of the enemy force, the rebel force, is too great, the wise thing to do is, like Washington did, let's get out of the way because we need our militia. Well, the militia seeking glory might take a 20-man unit and go against a 300-man rebel unit. And now we're less one militia unit. But if the intelligence is gathered properly by the Committee of Safety and the subordinate committees, and they say, look, there's 300 of them and there's 20 of you, they'll tell you what, you go that way, we'll tell them you went that way, and you get with some other people. When you guys can get 300 or 400 people together, you come back and we'll kick their butts. So the benefit of having that civilian unit there is they're not busy packing their gear and making sure they got enough bullets. They're busy trying to define, based on the information available, the intelligence available, what the best approach to the problem is. And the best thing we can have, as I say, is Vietnam veterans or somebody with military experience that can look at it realistically. One of the disadvantages of the Congress of the United States after the Declaration was that very few of them were military, except some of the generals that were pulled in later, like Gates. Very few were military-oriented, so they had their idea of what the military should do, and often they were wrong. They had an idea that they should appoint their friends generals, and that was chaotic sometimes. They had more people that were officers in the French and Indian Wars, they probably would have made more rational decisions on assignment of officers and delegation of assignments to Washington or other people on what they should or should not do. So the advantage of the Committee of Safety is pretty significant when you start to put it into perspective of a real-life situation. They're in a better place to make certain decisions. They're the corporate board, and they determine general policy. The details have to be worked out by the field commanders, and if they feel that something that they've been ordered to do is wrong, then they need to get back and convince the committee that, no, we can't go against those 300 people. But more than likely, in most decisions, the Committee of Safety will make a more rational decision than the individual field units are capable of doing as far as overall strategy. Does that answer your question?
Gotcha. But, you know, I think a lot of people really don't think a lot of these things out that we discuss when we talk about this plan that we're presenting. There's so many aspects to things that people don't realize, and Andy, grab your gun and go. There's an entire infrastructure, and a lot of people talk about bugging out. And we've talked about that as well. You know, you're looking at tens of thousands of Custer's last stands, basically. You know, if you're people that are stocking up food, stocking weapons, ammunition, things like that, waiting for them to come to them, you're basically barricading yourself in a home and you're looking at a Custer's last stand. So there's a lot of things that you need to look at so that doesn't happen. Infrastructure is important. A lot of people don't look at the fact that hospitals need to be maintained, courts need to be maintained, some kind of civil order must be maintained.
And to protect your family, the integrity of the community needs to be maintained. The grocery store needs to be maintained open. If you have a one-month supply of food and you run out, you want to have a resource. With the community, you can satisfy that resource. But think, too, if you're a bugging out, say, a 20-man unit bugging out, are you taking your families or not? When you bug out, are you going in the woods? If you're in the woods, you're a hot spot on infrared. If you stay in your community and mingle with the community, you can't be found out. There's a bunch of hot spots, and is every human being, every man, woman, and child is a hot spot in the city. Out in the woods, you're a big hot spot. You're a target. And with the equipment they've got nowadays, that is all that you are, is a target. If you bug out individually as a family, that's great. You're there to defend your family. But if you have to go hunting to get some food because you couldn't carry enough food in the field, you've left your family at the mercy of whoever might come in. Assuming you have, if it's just you and your wife, you can take your wife with you hunting. But as a collective unit, you've got a much greater ability for people to go do something that has be done without jeopardizing the security of the Committee of Safety unit, the unit that you've created through the Committee of Safety. And your first concern, obviously, is for Committee of Safety members. If you get large enough, then you incorporate the whole community. You've got aged people, for example, then you want to make sure, and they have no family, and you want to make sure they're fed. But you just expand out based on your capabilities to increase your defensiveness and your ability to supply necessities to that unit.
Well, that's pretty much, there's a lot to think about. And, one of those places for people to really start thinking about things like this on a local level, their own community, their home, if you will, even. You know, from your home to your neighborhood to your town to your community to your county. But there's a great book out there, Joseph P. Martino, retired colonel, Joseph P. Martino, wrote a book called Resistance to Tyranny. And it's not a how-to, it's a primer. It's a book to get you thinking about the things that you should be thinking about if you're ever thinking that you might have to resist tyranny. There's a link at the top of my website, uftredomy.com. It's the only yellow link there. It's called Resistance to Tyranny. Gives you an outline of the book and what it's about. Read the book, get the book. This book, I think, should be mandated reading for everyone. And if it would be mandated reading. Every militia member should read it. There should be several copies in it with every committee of safety out there. So check out that book. You know, a lot of the things that we're talking about here, you can get a more detailed explanation in that book as well. So, I think they go hand in hand.
Yeah, the background information, the understanding, the broadening of things you understand. A lot of times you'll hear something or read something and you say, damn, all those pieces he put together, but he's put it together in words, and now it comes together. That's what resistance to tyranny does.
We've got another caller, guys.
Bring him on, but let me finish. Bring him on, but let me just finish this.
Okay.
When Randy got Joe Martino on, I listened to the program, and then I contacted Joe and asked him for a copy of the book, and he sent it to me. I was fascinated, and honestly, any person with any responsible position in the militia or the Committee of Safety should read that book. It should be available on the shelf for anybody that's interested, even the lowest people in the committee, the lowest people in the militia, if they want to understand, have a good perspective of the entire aspect of resistance. Now, on that first conversation, too, is kind of ironic because Joe's talking about one thing that you've got to have is a plan. Well, I was almost done with the first run of the plan for restitution of constitutional government, so that's when I contacted Joe, sent him a copy. He's not responded yet, and I can understand why, because he still works, does, I guess, contract work for the government or something. But the plan that he was asking about was in a near-final form already, so his book and the plan become what he talks about, the only missing element there, and after we take this caller, we'll go into that, and it's called When to Start. You have a caller? Do you have a question?
Yeah, this is a Truth Detective. I'm friends with Lori, so she told me about your show and stuff, so I just kind of just caught your show maybe the last 15 minutes ago, but you guys were talking about militias and stuff, and my kind of take on that is, you may have already discussed this, I don't know for sure, but my thoughts on that is we all have the Second Amendment rights to bear arms, okay? And, you know, to protect ourselves from out-of-control government and protect our property. And while I'm away at work and we're all away at work and stuff, we can't be at home protecting our property. And that's why we elect a local sheriff. And our local sheriff, his sole duty is to uphold and defend the Constitution while we're away at work, defend our property, etc. What people don't realize, because of the corporate-run media, you'll always see a television show where the federal agents come into some hick town and run off a sheriff. Well, that's a bunch of BS. Your local sheriff in your county can tell the President of the United States or any federal agent under him to get the hell out of his county because this is his jurisdiction, because the people of his county elected him specifically to defend the Constitution. That's why they're having a real, real hard time getting rid of Joe Arpaio down there in Arizona, is because Sheriff Arpaio knows this. He knows that you cannot get rid of a standing sheriff. So when I look at say, the government coming in and intruding on a county, like, say, our county, and our sheriff says, you know, get the hell out of our county. I don't care if you're the President of the United States. I've got jurisdiction. I was elected solely to do this, to defend the Constitution. I feel that a militia is, when he needs the manpower to defend the Constitution, that's where he could swear in as many deputies or as many people as possible in his county. We go home, we get our guns, we come back, and there is our militia. We're led by the local sheriff. There's law and order. There's rule of law. And it's all an organized event. That's my take on the whole thing, to where, you know, the media is going to always get portrayed as a militia as being something that's going to be totally out of control, and people, it's going to be chaos in the streets. But if it's led by our local sheriff, then it's a whole different ball of wax. And that's why, if you really look at things, to back this stuff up, you'll always notice how the federal government always wants to cut funding to the sheriffs. You know, they always want to cut as much funding from your local sheriffs as possible. And what I think they've been trying to do with Joe Arpaio down there is they can't legally get rid of him, but what they do is they use these government-funded special interest groups to file frivolous lawsuits against him in order to influence the voters of his county not to keep reelecting them for a year. The government can't do it.
Well, we did discuss the sheriff and the... We did discuss the sheriff and the chief of police earlier on. We did discuss the sheriff and the chief of police earlier on committees of safety. Now, let me make a point about the sheriff. He is the executive, and his job is to carry out the laws. And that is true. If you get the sheriff on your side, you've definitely got an advantage because he has the equipment. He's got the manpower to assist the committees of safety and the militia. The militia is still justified. The sheriff can deputize people. If you read the linked article, Are Cops Constitutional, though, you might get a different picture of what the duties of the sheriff were 200 years ago. But remember, the sheriff is not a legislator. His job is to carry out the law. If he accepts the king's law, he's a bad guy. If he accepts only constitutional law, he's a good guy. But the constitutional law does not act as a legislative body. The Committee of Safety, however, can act as a legislative body. So the Committee of Safety can work with the sheriff if the sheriff is willing to work with the Committee of Safety.
Right, and that's
so you can't rely on a sheriff alone. He cannot make law.
I've delivered to sheriff offices and, you know, stations and stuff like that, and I've talked to them and stuff, and I've had people, you know, sheriff that he was just surprised. He never really realized the power and the control that he actually has if he's going to really take that oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. That's exactly what it is. But I may have misunderstood what you were just saying. I might have to listen to your answer off the phone here because you're cut. You know, it's just breaking up real bad. But
why don't you do that? Get off the phone and go back to listening, and I'll see if I can address it.
All right, yeah, because it's breaking up real bad. Sorry. All right, thanks.
Okay, go ahead. Okay. While I'm waiting for him to get back on, I saw somebody, sheriff had a jurisdiction over the police department. Police department, interesting word, policy man. He carries out the policy. Remember, policemen did not exist in 1789. They didn't exist until the early 1800s and only in a few cities, but they're policy enforcers. The city has the right to say, you can't walk down the streets with your guns on, i.e. Tombstone, Arizona, for the public safety. Once you leave town, you're back out in another area. Whether the sheriff has jurisdiction in town is enforcing its policies when you chose to live or be in the town is a question that I'm not sure the correct answer is the sheriff has jurisdiction over the police department. So back to what we were talking about, I'm going to be repeating myself, but I think you missed it, the caller, that the sheriff is the executive. His job is to carry out the laws. Back in colonial times, the sheriff would either opt to go with the Committee of Safety, if there were sheriffs, and not all counties had sheriffs back then, or he opted to stick with the royal government. If he stuck with the royal government, he was considered a Tory, and he was ignored. If he joined the Patriots, then he joined the colonists, then he joined the Whigs, he joined the Whigs. And that was great. That's the way it should be. But he cannot legislate. He cannot pass laws. He can only enforce a law that's on the books. Now, the Committee of Safety can act in a legislative capacity to enact laws for the safety of the community based on the circumstances, and then the sheriff can enforce those laws that are constitutionally enacted. And sheriffs have become revenue officers, too. So I hope that clarifies that the sheriff can only enforce laws that are made by a legislative body, just like the president can only enforce laws made by Congress. And within the state, the governor of the state can only enforce laws enacted by the state legislature. That's the separation of powers. The sheriff is the executive branch of government. His job is to execute the laws of the land. The legislator makes the laws of the land. The court then is supposed to administer justice, but we've been there already. So,
refer back to the three boxes for that.
Three boxes.
How did that election work out for you this last time around, Gary?
The what?
That election. You know, that election that was supposed that we had in 20, or you know, this last time around. For Congress, that was supposed to save our country, we're going to clean houses.
I didn't have one. I've I have returned to a state of nature. I know the one you're talking about. That's where 10 of 55 Tea Party candidates voted against continuation of the Patriot Act.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, see, that comes up to about roughly 2.5% of the, maybe closer to 2% of the number of representatives in the House of Representatives. That 2% then is not very close to being a majority, are they? No, quite a ways. They got a 25-fold before they even come close to being a majority. I have lost all faith in the process. This is early on in the legislative session. There are some things that you can expect to happen, and I use the analogy of Iowa. I just picked it. I don't know if they have any dams in Iowa. But Tea Party representative from Iowa gets elected on the Tea Party platform, and there's this dam that if it breaks, it's not going to kill a bunch of people, but it's going to flood three towns and destroy the towns because they were built in the floodplain, and we've got this surplus of water, and it's getting old, and it needs some maintenance. It's going to cost $1.5 million. So it goes to Washington. And he gets here and he writes a bill up that gives $1.5 million for the repair of this dam. And he says, what do I do with this bill? I want to get it passed. Well, you put it in that committee over there. So he goes and puts it in a committee. A couple of weeks later, he goes over to the committee and says, where's my bill? Oh, we're still considering it. A couple months later, he goes over and he says, well, where's my bill? They said, well, we're going to attach it as an amendment to the DREAM Act. So you can vote on the DREAM Act and you'll get your legislation passed. Well, I'm not going to vote on the DREAM Act. Oh, so you're not going to vote for your own bill? That's too bad. So after he served his 2 years in Congress, he got nothing done unless he is willing to trade his vote to get his product assigned to something else. So at the end of 2 years, you got two kinds of people out of the Tea Party. You got the ones to say, screw it, I can't get anything done, the system's rigged, I'll never get anything done, and I'm just going to go home and go back to selling hardware in my hardware store. Or the other one that says, well, I've learned how to play the game, now I can get what I need in my state, and all I have to do is go along with the DREAM Act, the Patriot Act, the Obamacare, and all this other stuff. So that's what's going to happen to these guys in the next year and a half. That's, I expect. Now, there's one other element that keeps the states from having it. Actually, there's two. The 17th Amendment should never have been ratified because it took away states' rights completely. It was the culmination of what began with the Reconstruction Acts of the 1860s. States' rights were lost, and all of a sudden these senators are elected just like the members of the House of Representatives, except they have more influence, more stature, and higher pay. But a state, let's say a state, well, Arpaio, federal government has money to give to communities that want to stop illegal immigration. However, Arpaio is not on that list, so they won't throw any dollars at him. Whether he receives any federal funds or not, I don't know. I can't really say. But I can tell you that Arizona does. Now, I'm looking at numbers from 2005. And I talked to a guy from New Jersey, and he said the New Jersey numbers are twice what I said they were when I read this 2005 stuff. So it's possible that they'll be twice as high. But Arizona paid to the federal government in taxes, as income tax, things like that. $35,988,000,000 went to the federal government. $36 billion in 2005 went to the federal government. Arizona was one of those lucky states because it got $1.19 back for every dollar it sent. It got back $44,639,000,000. Let's say a state, let's say Arizona starts getting uppity. Well, the federal government has strings on these purses, and they can pull those strings. What would happen if Arizona started losing some of that $44,639,000,000 because they weren't going along with the federal government? Suppose the federal government cut out $20 billion. What is Arizona, especially in this economy, what is Arizona going to do with 24 $1 billion less than they have right now to spend. If they need the money bad enough, they're going to have to raise the taxes on the citizens of Arizona. When they raise the taxes on the citizens of Arizona, the people of Arizona are going to get pissed off. Or they're going to have to cut the services drastically to offset that loss of $20 billion. Now, that's the final hold card on the part of the federal government. And we haven't seen it yet. But if you're wondering if it can happen, the Federal Highway Transportation Trust Fund dollars have been withheld from states back in the Drive 55 days if their average speeds measured under some program were greater than a certain amount. They started losing that money or all of it in some cases. So the government does have that final purse string, that final level of influence against the states revolting against the federal government.
Well, Gary, we are at the two-hour mark. Anything you want to say in closing?
Well, I hope you all have learned something. We haven't had a lot of questions, so maybe I answered them before you got there. You don't have any, but I do hope that that it's been beneficial for you to spend your time listening to this and that you've learned something. If you, as I say, if you want a copy of the draft final of the plan, which was finished in December, and I've got more to add to it that I haven't gotten back to it yet, email me or Randy, and Randy can pass it on to me, and I'll be glad to send you a copy so you can see the greater detail. If you think there's an alternative to the plan for restoration of constitutional government, I would appreciate it because I've been looking for 20 years for one. If you have an idea, I'd love to hear it. And thanks for listening.
All right, everybody. Thanks for being on, Gary. All right, everyone. As I was mentioning before, we're at the two-hour mark, so we're going to be closing it up for tonight now. Our show tomorrow night will be with the Ohio Minutemen Militia, Zach So, Major Cross. It's always a pleasure to have him on. I enjoy talking with him a lot. I enjoy his ideas. Always a great show when he's on. So that'll be tomorrow, same time, 7 p.m. Mountain Standard, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard, 8 p.m. Central Standard, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Again, please, at the top of the page, at the top of my website, youoftrenemy.com, there is a link up there to a book called Resistance to Tyranny, written by a retired colonel, Joseph P. Martino. If you only read one book in your lifetime, let it be that one book you read. If you never read anything else again, let it be that one book that you read. That's how important I think it is. I don't have anything else on my website. I don't hustle product. I don't sell anything. I don't ask for donations. And I'm not making any money at promoting his book. I'm promoting it because I think it's that important. I think it's that good of a book. So do yourself a favor. Take a look at it. If you have any questions or if you want to be on the email list, emails go out for each for the upcoming shows. I don't promote or market my shows anywhere else anymore. I don't have the time, so the only way to really get the updates for the shows is to be on the email list. So if you have any questions or comments or you want to be on the email list, contact me at randymack@youoftrenemy.com. Next week we're also going to have a friend of mine on from the Tennessee Militia. His name is Morg. He goes by Morg. This guy's going to be, he's going to be talking to us about some things down in Tennessee, including the state's recognition, actual recognition, and beginning to fund the militia down there. So we're going to be talking to him about that. Things always seem to start in Tennessee. So he'll be on not this coming Monday, but the following Monday. So we'll see everybody there. You all take care.
Let me add one more note. On Tuesday, we're going to have a conference call on committees of safety. Okay, you go ahead, Randy.
I'm sorry about that. No, I forgot about that. Go ahead, Gary.
Okay, we're going to have a Committee of Safety conference call. It's going to be treated not like a it's going to be kind of similar to this, except we're relying more on questions and answers. I've received a number of questions. We'll go with them. You're welcome to ask any questions you want regarding Committees of Safety and their relationship to militia. I'm not an expert in militia, except their relationship to committees of safety and their obedience and their historical obedience to history. But it's going to be specific to that area, and I think it'll be an interesting program for you that are interested in committees of safety and or militia. So it'll be at 5 o'clock, an hour earlier, on Tuesday. And we want to get the East Coast people.
So a couple questions. I mean, we, you know, it's hard to, you know, I know where the shows are going. When I interview guests and things like that, we know where the show, you know, I have a general idea of where the show is going to go. I know where my questions are going to go anyways. But I don't always ask the questions that you need answered for yourself. So it doesn't take a lot to participate. It's a question. Get in there, ask your questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be shy. Don't be shy to ask questions. There's no such thing as a stupid question, except the question that you never ask. So keep that in mind. Come prepared with your questions tomorrow. That'll be tomorrow. That'll be Tuesday. Sorry, Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard, 6 p.m. Mountain Standard, 7 p.m. Central Standard, and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So other than that, anything else, Gary?
That's it. Look forward to seeing all these people and even more on Tuesday.
All right, everybody, guys, take care. Be safe. Be free. We're done. Bye-bye.